time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Peter Linebaugh. Peter Linebaugh is professor of history at the University of Toledo. He has taught at Harvard and the Attica Correctional Facility, New York University, and the Federal Penitentiary in Marion, Illinois. He has published articles in Counterpunch, The New Left Review, The Times Literary Supplement, The Canadian Journal of History, New York University Law Review, International Socialism, and The Nation. He co-edited Albion's Fatal Tree, Crime and Society in 18th Century England, along with Doug Hay and E.P. Thompson. He is the author of The London Hanged, Crime and Civil Society in the 18th Century, The Many-Headed Hydra, Sailors, Slaves, Commoners, and the Hidden History of the Revolutionary Atlantic, co-authored with Marcus Redeker, and his latest book, The Magna Carta Manifesto, Liberties and Commons for All. Peter, thank you very much for spending time with us this morning.
You're very welcome, Mike.
Start out, if you would, with the motivation in writing your latest book, The Magna Carta Manifesto.
The motivation was the simultaneous war and aggression in Iraq and Afghanistan on the one hand, and then on the other hand, the imprisonment without charges of men and women in Guantanamo and the wholesale destruction of liberties in the USA under the regime of the Bush. The autocracy and tyranny seemed to be coming from every direction, and it was time to look deep into history and to see what are the bases of, or some of the manuscript basis of human liberty, and see whether or not such old charters as Magna Carta might help us now.
I remember very little from my schooling about the Magna Carta, so I'm hoping you can bring us up to speed on that.
Mike, I was in the same boat, and that's, I knew hardly anything, and that's what sent me back to it. Well, I'm a historian, so I love dates. Let's go back to 1215, June 15th, 1215. Bad King John in England is forced by a whole array of circumstances to sue for an armistice in a civil war. This is in feudal Europe, a time of the Crusades, a time of beginning of commodity production, a time of hostility between Christians, Jews, and Muslims, and above all, a time of expropriation of peasants and throughout Europe. Also a time of heresy. 1215 was the same year as the Lateran Council, the beginning of the Inquisition in Europe. So it was a very big turning point in global history. Magna Carta itself is 63 chapters. Each of these is just two or three lines long. It was written in Latin, became a foundation for English law, the charters of English liberty. Tom Paine said the American colonies needed to have something like it, and as a result, we had the Declaration of Independence. Of course, that's 1776. The chapter 39 of Magna Carta is the one that's often carved on the walls of American courthouses. Students used to be required to memorize it, and it says that no free man shall be deprived of his liberty without judgment by his peers and due process of law. And already, I think, we hear echoes of this in the U.S. Constitution. And indeed, the American Supreme Court has quotes and refers to Magna Carta ever since the beginning of the Supreme Court. That's trial by jury, prohibition of torture, habeas corpus, due process of law, all are legal principles that derive from this two or three lines of Chapter 39 of Magna Carta. And lawyers, historians, English history nerds, we go back and study this and look at it, but we had forgotten during the much of the post-war, second half of the 20th century. And it's time to recall these principles. And as I did so, Mike, I came across even a deeper forgetting. Whereas not only the Magna Carta, I said the charters of English liberty. There was two of them. And the second one was the Charter of the Forest. And coming here to the Northwest from the Great Lakes region where I live, I was very conscious of this, you know, flying over the mountains and trying to see what forest remained and what did not. For the conquerors of England, the Norman conquest, they came in with their own forest law, which was to preserve the forest basically as a game preserve to the kings. But others who had been using this habitat for millennia, for cattle pasturage, for pigs, for pannage in the forest, as a pharmacopoeia, simple one for the peasantry, for fuel, for this was the woodland epoch of history, in contrast to coal or petroleum. Common people had common rights in the forest, and the Charter of the Forest recognized and acknowledged this fact of a commons in the energy habitat of that era. And it was this discovery of mine that just blew me away, because it seemed that in our epoch, the feminization of poverty, the deprivation of forests, the increased immigration and boat people and transfer of huge populations from one continent to another arose from the absence of rights to subsistence. So I made a parallel between the woodland epoch and the petroleum period. And it was these two themes that are interwoven in the work that I produced, the Magna Carta Manifesto, the theme of subsistence for all and the theme of protections against autocracy or tyranny.
So who were the principal authors of the Magna Carta?
I'm not as sophisticated as I'd like to be in answer to your question, because in a way I want to dodge it. It's not, I think there are some individuals. Stephen Langton, the Archbishop of Canterbury, comes to mind first of all. But the reason I want to dodge it is that he responds to social forces. And so his authority as an author is a collective one. He has to negotiate with barons, with merchants, with peasantry in order to attain stability in this armistice that Magna Carta is. It's a peace treaty, basically, between class forces. So sometimes we hear the word author and we have a notion of individuality that I think it contrasts with the anonymity that otherwise the historian is faced with. You know, the old English ditty, the law locks up the man or woman who steals the goose from off the common, but lets the greater villain loose who steals the common from the goose. This is anonymous, and when we think about it, we see the principle of incarceration or enclosure and criminalization on the one hand is logically and historically tied to the deprivation of subsistence and the commons on the other hand. So, you know, I contrast individuality with anonymity. But in answer to your question.
Yeah, I guess I wasn't really looking so much for individuals, more to if it was like the elite that wrote it, or if the regular commoners were fairly represented within it.
Very, very important question. But certainly they're represented in it very powerfully in Chapter 7 of Magna Carta, which grants to the widow her reasonable estovers in the common, where estovers means a subsistence access to wood. So they respond to commoners. It's not until really the 17th century, the time of the slave trade, the time of the witch burnings, the time of the settlement of European people in North America, that the common people begin to appear on history in their own name, so to speak. This is the time of the English Revolution, the time of the levelers, the time of the diggers. And England wants to export them, get rid of them, and hence the settlement or colonization of the American colonies, and the indentured servants, and the white slavery. With those charters of the American colonies is often the verbatim Chapter 39 from Magna Carta, which now reappears in human history on the other side of the ocean and as a principles of Virginia, Massachusetts, and some other colonies. And it's from there that then Thomas Paine or the founders of the USA derive their link, Magna Carta, to the Declaration of Independence and then to the American legal tradition.
Was the Magna Carta written primarily at one point in time, or has it been added to over the years?
Yes, another good question, and that really occupies scholars, because it's an evolving principles. Even at the beginning, it was written in Latin. There are about 17 copies of it that clerks would write out. But right away it was published, and the way they published back then was not by print. Remember, this is before print, but by reading it aloud from pulpits in cathedrals. And it was read aloud in Latin, it was read in Norman French, and it was read even in English by the 14th century. After the Renaissance, after the era of print, it becomes more widespread. But the notion of publication or broadcasting is one that's not just print, not just software, but was the human voice, you know, viva voce. This is how Magna Carta and the Charter of the Forest was made known. But even in the Middle Ages, the peasantry was, of course, suspicious of print and writing, as often that contained traps for them. And in the great peasant revolts of the Middle Ages, one of the targets was the destruction of such manuscripts. But there were also among peasants those who were literate and who were able to read the gold and azure letters of the inks of the precious and beautiful parchment manuscripts of that time. I was interested in this, Mike, because I was saying, well, where did they get these inks from? You know, and the gold inks would come from Africa. The azure inks or blue inks would come from lapis lazuli, and that would be Afghanistan and Persia. So here, these great manuscripts of the Middle Ages have their material existence in Africa and in Central Asia. I was fascinated by this. But of course, it is the meanings of the charters are ones that, as I said earlier, grow and evolve with human struggle. And I think it's time again for them to change in relationship to the dire needs that we face now.
You mentioned a term, the feminization of poverty. Can you define that?
Well, just that... looking at the, you know, demographic pyramid or structure of human life, we are all our mother's children. Our reproduction depends on the health of women. Our existence, not just as in parturition, not just in birth, but our nurturance as infants depends on her access to subsistence. And it is this which has been so severely threatened in the era of neoliberalism, you know, from Chiapas, from Bolivia to Kenya to South Africa to Sumatra or Indonesia. It's the elderly, it's the children, and it's the women who suffer first. And so with the huge crises brought about by the expropriation from land, from forest, from waters, and their privatization. The women will suffer first. And so that's what I mean by the feminization of poverty in our own era.
We are talking with Professor Peter Leinbach. He is author of the book, The Magna Carta Manifesto, Liberties and Commons for All. So you had also mentioned that the Magna Carta was essentially like a peace plan to end a class war that was going on. Did it indeed end the class war then?
Eventually. The class war takes other forms. It so far hasn't ended. I don't want to get too reductionist here. I think we all need to think about this subject much, much more than we do. It's a power relation. In the Middle Ages, Magna Carta was a kind of a settlement. It was a truce. We have important principles that derive from it and more that can derive from it. But in itself, it is no answer to our problems. It is on our side, should we choose to employ it. Mike, there was one other thing, I think perhaps the most important thing in Magna Carta, and I forgot to mention it yesterday at the wonderful National Lawyers Guild conference on the law of the commons, and that is perhaps the most important principle of all in Magna Carta, and the one that certainly attracted Tom Paine, and perhaps the time will come when we need it. And that is the principle of resistance to autocratic power by any means necessary. Yes, that's the foundation in Magna Carta. And that's, I think, something that many of us are thinking now.
So is that literally written into the Magna Carta?
Yes. Yes, it is. There's not only the principle of resistance, but the principle of reparations. Bad King John had to return the forests that he had taken, his brother, Richard the First, Richard the Lionhearted, had taken forests left, right, and center over England. And their father, Henry the Second, had done the same. The principle of reparations is in Magna Carta, in that all these forests had to be returned. Justice involved restitution, material restitution for crimes done, for harm caused. And so the Magna Carta is also a great redress of grievances and can also be used in our debates about reparations.
So I'm sure you're familiar with that saying that the victors of a war always get to write the history books, and applying that to the class warfare, it appears that, at least here in the States, you don't generally, at least in the corporate media, hear about class warfare. There is no class in the United States. We're all one big happy family.
Well, yes, of course. we know the line. But then I think, how many families have a copy, you know, near at hand in the kitchen of Howard Zinn's People's History of the USA? I'm sure many of your listeners do, or how many of us, you know, will purchase that book to give to one of our children for a birthday or graduation present. How many of us know that what we learn from our grandparents and their struggles is so at odds with the line from the corporate media, as you were saying? So when we have to fight for our history, when we have to honor our grandparents in the knowledge of the past, then history lives. If it's just spoon-fed from the pablum of the corporate media and the institutionalization of the fog factories of American corporate education that just bows down to standardized tests and turns us all into cogs in a machine, when we fight against that, we do so with our own mind. We do so with our own struggles, and then it lives.
But I was reminded that while you were talking that A, that you pointed out that resistance is written into the Magna Carta, as well as documents that were written after that, I believe.
Yes, the Declaration of Independence is always good to read. I'm always disappointed on the 4th of July on how infrequently it's read, but it lists 24 reasons for throwing out the king. And, of course, it's not just the king, but it's all levels of autocracy, from the little bosses that rule over us, the wilderness of turnpike gates, to use a phrase of Tom Paine's, you know, the bureaucratic nightmares that many of us have to suffer. Yes, this is monarchy. It's not just the king, but it's a structure of tyranny and autocracy that the Declaration of Independence can help us resist.
As well, were there any mention of reparations within the Declaration of Independence and or the Constitution?
No, because here, Mike, we have the other side, and I don't want to get too dewy-eyed on this. You know, the Declaration of Independence is the start. It's a settler's document. And in the 1770s and the next decade, the idea was to take the lands of the Shawnee, the Iroquois, the Potawatomi, and the Miamis in the Ohio Valley. Yes, and of course it came with the slave plantation. So we don't get dewy-eyed about any of these documents. We don't worship them. They're not idols. We respect our history from below, but we also use our critical intelligence and realize that the USA is a settler society based upon the robbery of lands, and then it became a great slave society. And we honor these struggles that have seek reparations for these wrongs. And we look into our own past as immigrants from Asia, from Europe, from Africa, in order to rectify them and build a future worth living, a future without destruction, a future without building weapons of destruction. Looking for an economy that's not based on bullying. Yes.
So do you feel that if documents like the Magna Carta were more a part of our regular everyday lives, that we wouldn't, as a nation and a world, be in the same situations that we are now?
I think if the principles in the document were brought alive again by many subsequent documents, the 14th Amendment, I think the Article 7A of the National Recovery Administration and the New Deal, the Wagner Act, there are many documents of human liberation that can be brought to us. I got interested in Magna Carta mainly because it has a deep and venerable interest among lawyers. And as I say, I was just utterly blown away by what I found in it. And, you know, Bush and so many of his own lawyers, from John Yoo to Gonzalez, I mean, I don't want to upbraid them for being bad English history students. I don't think that's really the issue. But they are torture mongers. They're autocrats. They are servants to the powerful. And it's up to us to renew law as a basis of equality and solidarity.
I have about 5 minutes left. So you are a historian. Can you give us your sense of where we are at this point in time? We have a new administration in D.C. that appears to be heading in a slightly different direction than the previous administration. What's your sense for where things are heading?
Well, I think, I'm very interested, very curious. Of course, I'm susceptible to the charm of the young president. Of course, I shed a tear over the struggles of the past, of the American civil rights movement. Yes, of course, I have share these emotions with everyone. But as for the planet, as for the policies, as for the bailout, it doesn't bode well to believe that as we the solution to lost homes, the solution to the destruction of music in schools, is to pay bankers money. It just seems counterintuitive, doesn't it? You know, what kind of economy is that? To me, human subsistence. And it's not just a matter of bankers or Wall Street people, you know, having expensive rugs or toilets made of gold. No, I think it's deeper than that. And how to meet and create our own needs. I think people have begun to think about this in a more open mind. Using the righteousness and justice of our anger, but also, I think, searching for one another. I would like to say something about the new people coming to the United States. Immigrants from all over the world will bring experiences here that we have lost. We are powerful, but we are weak in knowledge. When I say we, I mean the USA. People outside are weak in material goods, but often strong in experience. In the struggles against autocracy of Central America, or of West Africa, or of Pakistan, or India. So, the globalization of bringing people together, I think, may bode well for us in the future.
So, are you working on your next book at this point in time?
Yes, Mike, I'm really interested in with Tom Paine. You know, I've just written an introduction to the republication of agrarian justice and the rights of man and common sense, and really learned a lot about Tom Paine. I think he's wonderful, and basically, you know, he wants to start anew. His notion of revolution is a new beginning, and not obeisance and getting down on our knees to the dead hand of the past. He also has an interest in fairness and equality for all, in material terms, not just in terms of voting or representation, but in terms of livelihood, of social security, of human welfare, of the Commonwealth. So this being the bicentennial of his death, the poor guy, man, you know, at his funeral, a woman showed up, Madame de Bonneville, a French woman, two African Americans, and a handful of United Irishmen. Otherwise, all those whose pen had led a revolution ignored him and dissed him at the very end. This 2009 is the 200th anniversary of his death. So that's what I've been interested in recently.
What was it, briefly, that caused those to break, that he had shared so much with, to break ranks with him?
Oh, yeah. Well, he was imprisoned in France during the Terror, and just by the angel of death passed him by. By a curious accident. But Gouverneur Morris was the American ambassador to Paris, and behind him George Washington was president, and they didn't lift a finger to save him from the guillotine. And I think this certainly angered him, angered Tom Paine. Tom Paine was an egalitarian, and of course the great Federalists of the first decade of American history were not. They were slavocrats. They were American aristocrats. They were plutocrats. They worshiped money. And while Tom Paine was by no means a leveler, he was egalitarian, and they didn't like this. He thought that revolution was... He was a citizen of the world.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, with that, we're unfortunately out of time. So I'd very much like to thank you for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Mike, it's been my pleasure.
We have just been talking with Professor Peter Linebaugh. He is author of the book, The Magna Carta Manifesto, Liberties and Commons for All.